Okay, so I've been working on this project with Doug Johnson from HIA. I'm Norm Murray, he's my supervisor. So I am a student. This is the outline of the talk. I'll start with an introduction. I'll talk really short, briefly on viscous accretion. And I'll focus on photo evaporation, show some results, conclusions, and future work. So let me start with an introduction for photo evaporation. The first models for photo evaporation were actually developed for high mass stars by David Hollenbach. And they explain the long lifetime of these regions, these ultra-compact H2 regions, by having this reservoir of this material and evaporate it. If there was no evaporation of a high mass star disk, you can calculate what's the sun speed in these high density, high temperature regions, and they would dissipate really quickly. So the fact that we can still see them is explained by having a disk that's been evaporated. Well, my main interest for planet formation and planet migration is the migration by the gas disk planet gravitational interaction, because you would expect to have migration as you remove the gas disk. There is a nice review for all the possible disk removal mechanisms in protostars and planets. I think it's volume 4 by Hollenbach as well. So of course, viscous accretion onto the central star, evaporation, stellar clusters, stellar winds, and planet formation. It is a disk removal mechanism. Now, the dominant mechanisms for a wide variety of parameters are viscous accretion and evaporation. Stellar encounter is not dominant, because even for high stellar density environments such as Orion, it turns out that evaporation by external stars dominates stellar encounters when you're thinking about disk removal. Stellar winds are not that so efficient, because the winds are usually collimated away from the disk plane, and they're also powered by accretion, so you can't remove the disk really efficiently and then have a powerful outflow at the same time. So you need that accretion power emission. I would like to just remind that when you have a viscous disk, I'm not considering photo evaporation here, I'm just talking about viscous accretion. The minimum energy state is approach as you move material, the inner disk moves closer to the central star, but you have to conserve angular momentum, so you need to have outer material moving out. So you have both viscous spreading of the outer regions and accretion onto the central star. And there is a typical or a characteristic transition radius that defines what's the region that's moving inward and what's the region that's moving outward. This transition radius is moving outward as well due to viscous diffusion. So for the following models, I assume a standard alpha disk model, the Shakura Sianyaev viscosity.
What alpha value do you assume?
Between 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2. Which is supposed to be consistent with the observed accretion rates from the Tauri stars. And I just want to show first, these protoplanetary disks have been identified as evaporating, but this is evaporation by external stars, not the central star. The disks are inside these cocoons of gas. This gas material comes from evaporated gas material. But as I said before, this is evaporation by external stars. And I'm gonna concentrate or evaporation by the central star. So this is just a cartoon diagram. We have the central star, the molecular thin disk. Now, when you're thinking of evaporation by the central star, the EUV flux from the central star creates an ionized atmosphere. By the way, I should also point out that Frank Shu used this model to for a possible explanation between the differences, the gas-rich giants and the gas-poor giants. I'll go back to that in a second. So you form the EUV flux or the EUV photons from the central star. They ionize this material. They form this ionized atmosphere. Now, if you pick a particular disk location, you can calculate what's the escape velocity from the central star and compare that velocity to the sound speed of the ionized material. If the sound speed is higher than that escape velocity, you can remove this material. So that defines a gravitational radius, it's this one here, this one, just by that argument, just comparing the escape velocity to the sound speed of the ionized material. So anything, any ionized material inside this region is gravitationally bound to the central star. We can't get rid of that that easily. So this makes the picture more complicated, because now you have this ionized atmosphere. That means the direct EUV flux from the central star, it can't penetrate the outer disk, but it gets absorbed by recombined hydrogen in this atmosphere. So what actually dominates the flux onto the outer disk, it's a diffuse flux created in this ionized atmosphere by recombinations. So there's one consequence of this is that evaporation is going to be most efficient in this region, just outside the gravitational radius, because this diffuse flux, it has the best shining angle in this region. It also suffers less attenuation in this region. It doesn't have to travel that far. So that's one of the features for evaporation by the central star. It's not the direct flux from the central star, but this diffuse flux. But the diffuse flux is, of course, controlled by the direct EUV flux. As I said, the most evaporation region, the most efficient region for evaporation is just outside this gravitational radius. Now you can estimate what's the viscous diffusion time scale at a particular disk radius, compare that to the disk removal time scale by evaporation, and it turns out that the disk removal time scale by evaporation could be higher than the viscous diffusion time scale. That means viscous diffusion is trying to spread the disk and evaporation is trying to remove this material. But if you have a higher for evaporation removal rate, you can open a gap in this location and you can estimate what's the maximum surface density for this to happen. I should explain. In this equation, alpha is the viscous parameter. This is the number of EUV photons from the central star, and it doesn't have a really strong dependence on this ionizing flux from the central star. RG is that gravitational radius I was mentioning. So anything inside this radius is trapped inside the gravitational field of the central star. Now, one of the problems with evaporation is this value for the number of photons, EUV photons, from the central star. For the sun, is around 10 to the 37, 38, and there's only one reference we found. It's not easy to get this value from observations. Now, if you look at T Tauri stars, the international ultraviolet explorer, it doesn't go all the way down to 912 angstroms or to the EUV photon. So the best we could do is extrapolate the FUV flux to the EUV, and that probably underestimates the flux. So that's why this 10 to the 40 value is typically assumed, but it doesn't come from real observations. It's just an estimate. You expect T-Tauri stars to be chromospherically active, so they should have a higher EUV flux, but there aren't any observational constraints on this value. The good thing is that it doesn't have a really strong dependence on this ionizing flux. So changing by two orders of magnitude, it just gonna change it by one order. So as I said before, if the surface density at the gravitational radius is lower than this value, you can open a gap by photo evaporation. I'm gonna have to distinguish gaps due to evaporation from gaps due to planets. But it's gonna get confusing.
Yeah. 2.4 AU, that's a very low surface density.
Yeah. So
what circumstances do you expect to have?
Yeah, I'll show that in a second. So if you take the minimum solar nebula, that 2.4, it's roughly 1 gram per centimeter, right? That's really low compared to minimum solar nebula. So for that to happen, you have to reduce the surface density first, right? But we can do that by evaporation. So we don't open this gap instantaneously. You have to lower the surface density until you reach that threshold value, and then we can open this gap. Now, what I'm showing here is snapshots of the surface density of the disk. That's for a high flux. That's for a lower flux. So it's surface density versus radius. I start with a minimum solar nebula distribution. So if you look at the surface density at the gravitational radius, this dotted line is the gravitational radius location, both plots. It's roughly 1,000, right? Which is the minimum solar nebula initially. So it starts with this surface density distribution. Now these are snapshots, so that's zero. These numbers here indicate the time in millions of years. So as you can see, this time scale between zero and one, so between t equals zero when we start, and 1 million years is simply the viscous diffusion time scale. And you can see here that it's really slow, right? It's 1 million years and then 10 million years to get to this region. So we can only, and this, I put this red line just to show where we reach that threshold value where we can open this photo evaporation gap. But it only occurs after roughly 20 million years. So it is pretty long. Even when you consider typical disk lifetimes, right? So roughly 1 million years, 10 million years. But that's when we can open this gap.
Before the red line, it's all viscous diffusion.
Well, it's both, right? Because you are, we have evaporation turned on at all times from the beginning. It's just until you reach this value, viscous diffusion, even if you open a gap by evaporation, you diffuse it, right? By viscous diffusion, if it's not strong enough. So it has to reach this value. Now, the interesting thing is, after you open this gap, you can kind of think of two independent regions with two different viscous timescales, right? They're separated by this evaporation gap. So the time scale for evolution is much, much faster in this inner disk region. And that's because the viscous diffusion time scale goes like, is proportional to the radius. So the viscous diffusion time scale in this region is much, much faster, the evolution, than this region. You can see how the inner disk is quickly removed compared to the outer disk once you open this gap and you disconnect these two regions. As I said before, it has a weak dependence on the ionizing flux. So I'm increasing the flux by two orders of magnitude in this case. And the good thing, of course, is that we can open this gap earlier at 6 million years compared to 20 million, but it doesn't change much. Now this rapid inner disk removal, that's actually observed in T Tauri stars. So when you look at estimates for lifetimes of disks around T Tauri stars, they're always looking at infrared excess, which traces the inner disk, not the outer disk. So if I want to compare typical disk lifetimes to this surface density evolution, I should look at the lifetime of this region, not this region. So that's roughly, I don't know, between around tens of millions of years.
What's the other observations that much longer away ones that?
Oh yeah,
there are
submillimeters observations. That those are, it's much longer the lifetime. So it is consistent with this picture.
It's interesting that the outer disk gets more dense than the inner disk during that region.
Yeah, and I didn't say why this happens, right? I said, so one thing is the viscous diffusion timescale. It just, the typical diffusion timescale is shorter in this region. But the main reason for this is, first, you have accretion onto the central star, right? At this inner boundary. You also have viscous spreading of this inner annuli to outside a gravitational radius where you can remove by evaporation. So you have two really efficient mechanisms for this inner annuli. But for the outer annuli, you can't remove this material outward, right? You just spread the disk, but you're not removing the material. And you can remove material at the inner edge of the outer annuli. But as the edge resides from the gravitational radius, for evaporation becomes less efficient. So it takes longer and longer to remove this region.
So do you include any flow across the gap or inward from the
Once I open this gap, I'm not putting any flow. So I disconnect the two regions.
Is there any reason?
I think there should be some flow. If you look at planet simulations when they open these gaps, we can see. The other thing is this is all, it's a thin two-dimensional disk, right? It doesn't have a three-dimensional structure.
I have another question concerning the basics of this one. So you don't solve the diffusion equation for sigma
here? I use the diffusion equation. It's just once I completely clear a region, then it's just zero, right? The surface density. But I am using the viscous diffusion equation, and I'm adding evaporation by the central star.
So this requires you have spreading towards the gap, which is removed by evaporation before it gets there.
Yeah. So in other words, that's a really good point. If there was no viscous spreading, evaporation wouldn't be so efficient because you need that viscous spreading outside the gravitational radius. That was just to show the typical disk lifetime. So what I was saying, that's the, I think it's H, this is inferred from H minus K versus J minus K, or it's the infrared excess. You can see that. So it says there too, it's from Hillenbrand. It's the inner disk fraction. And by, what is this? Between 6 and 7 million years, you have the inner disk completely removed. And that would be roughly consistent if you have a high ionizing flux. It's a little bit long if you have a lower ionizing flux. Now, I can at a given dislocation, I can calculate what's the mass inside of an annulus with the Hill radius, just to have an idea what's the feeding zone at this dislocation for possible planet formation. The good thing is that the best regions, or in other words, where I have most of the available material, is outside this gravitational radius. I'm gonna show you why that's a good thing. Now, one thing I can do, I can't track type 1 migration just by looking at the disk flow, right? But I can try to do something with type 2 migration, since once the planet opens the gap, it's going to be locked to the viscous diffusion evolution of the disk. So what I have here is the disk streamlines, where I only have lines in this region, so between 8 and 22 astronomical units. And that's because that's the disk region where I have enough material to form, I think I put 0.1 Jupiter masses in this case. Now, and as I said, at the very beginning, there is viscous spreading outwards, right? If you put planets in the outer disk, because you have to conserve total angular momentum. Now, the reason for this turnaround, it doesn't keep going outward all the time, is this evaporation gap, right? Because once you're, let's say, in this region, you're probably, if you're in this region for these two surface density distributions, you're probably moving inward. And let's say you kept moving outward until you reach this region. Once evaporation is dominant, this region starts to move inward, because this is actually the inner region for the outer annuli. Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand this.
This one?
Yeah.
So what? Okay. So what I do here is I put, basically, I'm following the disk particle. So I put a label on a disk particle, and I'm just following it in the disk. So if I put a disk particle like that was 10 to the 4 years, something like that, at 8 AU, it goes straight to the central star.
Okay.
If I put as I go outward, I increase my chances of survival, right? Just because I'm in the outer disk where material goes outward. So that, yeah, you can think of it as disk streamlines, or I'm not putting planets, I'm just plotting the disk streamlines, or I'm following the disk particles.
The division between the dotted lines and the solid.
This dotted line is the gravitational radius. The solid line is the time scale where the evaporation gap forms. Now, I put two colors here just because the blue lines, they all end up in the inner boundary, so they reach the central star, or there might be some mechanism to stop migration there. But the red lines, we can actually stop them by this photo evaporation gap. Now, the problem with this is, again, the time scale, right? It's really long. So unless type 1 migration was, in other words, we have to deal with type 1 migration first before this, because a planet probably starts in type 1 migration, then it switches to type 2. Now, if that gap opening time occurs after the gap opening formation and at these locations, then we can stop them. But this is really long, right? 2 times 10 to the 7 years compared to typical type 1 migration timescales. Even now, the other possibility is, what if we think about rapid planet formation by disk instability? In that case, they should attach themselves to the disk really quickly, and then we can just follow these streamlines, and we know which ones are going to survive, just the red ones or just the planets that start in this region. And
what's the difference between the dotted line and the solid line? Each curve is starting as dotted.
Oh, yeah, sorry. So I put this 10 to the 7 was just, I can't remember why I did this, but I think it was. I think it was.
Characters in this lifetime,
it could be this lifetime. It could be that I don't know what's gonna happen before this, right? Because anything can happen due to type 1 migration. So I'm not really following the streamlines. So I was talking about rapid formation by this instability, but so I'm saying that we can stop the planets if they form this region between 18, 22 AU, but I have to check if I can really have a unstable disk in this region, right? So I have 1 over Q, the Thunberg Q parameter, and the answer is no, because I need the only way I can make this region unstable is a really, these numbers are disk masses in units of the central star. So I need a really high mass disk.
This is instability for what?
For the disk. Yeah, for the gas disk. Yeah. Okay. Now, the problem, the previous plots, they don't correspond to this value of the disk mass. They correspond to this one. And as I showed before, you need to reach that minimum surface density, right, to open the evaporation gap. So increasing the disk mass is going to delay that time scale for the evaporation gap. So everything ends up inward. We can't stop them. Just the conclusions. The combination of the two mechanisms, viscous accretion plus evaporation, is an efficient disk removal mechanism. And I should point out that only using evaporation or only using viscous accretion is not efficient. If you only have evaporation, you can spread the material outside the gravitational radius. If you only have viscous accretion, you simply diffuse the disk. So it might be possible to stop type 2 migration, but I can't conclude anything from this, right? Because I haven't dealt with type 1 migration.
But the time scale is still tens of millions of years.
Yeah, it's really long. That unless this the EUV flux from the central star is really high, so I'm using 10 to the 42 as the optimistic value and 10 to the 40 as the pessimistic value. If that's really, really high, then we can do something, but just guessing, right? The good thing about all these uncertainties in the flux is that this evaporation is not strongly dependent on these flux. There is a square root dependence. I put some references for more details and some future work. I have to consider evaporation by external stars because, of course, that's going to be much, much faster. I have some simulations, and it's roughly 10 to 5 years to remove the entire disk. The problem is we're not going to have gaps by photo evaporation in this case because you remove the disks from the outside, not from the inside, so there won't be any gaps. Another interesting thing is Andrew's idea of gravitational instability of the solid disk, not the gas disk. So if we can really enhance the metallicity or the solid to gas ratio by evaporation, we might have gravitational instability of the solid disk. I'm not talking about the gas disk now. I'm talking about the solid disk. The problem is in these evaporation models, all we are assuming a disk wind, right? So it's not clear that we're taking only the gas and not the dust particles. The good thing is that the dust settling timescale is much, much shorter than this evaporation timescale. So I think we can play a little bit with this. And I made this plot right after Ed's talk last week, just to show how much mass are we evaporating at the end of the story. So if you have a low EUV flux from the central star, it's really a small fraction of the initial disk mass that's been evaporated as opposed to accreted to the central star. But it gets fairly high for a high EUV flux. Roughly half of the initial disk mass is evaporated and not accreted.
What mass central star do you think fluxes correspond to?
Solar mass.
But you sort of arbitrarily assume what UV plus.
Yeah, we don't have any constraints. I think that's it. Yeah.
Other questions?
A question concerning this 1D model that you were talking about. Obviously, a disk has some vertical thickness, and in principle, one needs to do a 2D model. And has that been investigated, what effects that might have? For example, you might have disk self-shadowing of the disk.
Yeah.
I mean, you might heat the inner parts, and that shadows the outer parts, which complicates.
There is a Zeus simulation by Andrea Font, Doug Johnston. I can't remember for this, but their main conclusion is that the speed at which you remove material by evaporation, it's not the sun speed, but it's a little bit smaller. It's a third or something like that in their simulations. Now that gravitational radius, in the original theory of Cranshu, his gravitational radius is just outside Jupiter and Saturn. That's how he was trying to explain the difference between the gas-rich giants and the gas-poor giants. That gravitational radius in those simulations is closer to the central star. And that's what I'm using here. There is another work by Kathy Clark where she shows that the accretion columns, they're really optically thick to this EUV flux from the central star. So that basically they're showing that's going to be an issue if you're thinking about EUV flux from accretion. So you can't have a high accretion powered EUV flux because basically all the photons are going to be absorbed in these accretion columns. They're optically thick. But other than that, I don't think there's any work. Maybe Dulemond have something. Yeah.
He investigated, I think, the self-shadowing effects.
Yeah.
Which you might have, I think, for a certain disk mass. I can't remember the details.
They have an effect for the temperature, right? The disk temperature, but we'll have to see if that inner rim is optically thick or thin to the UV flux.
I couldn't actually tell in your last figure what the I think I've talked with Doug about this before. You're making the assumption, right, that particles sort of settle to the midplane and the evaporation is just gas. And so what are the enhancement factors that you sort of get for that? Is that in these plots or?
Well, in the original models, that wasn't assumed, right? It was actually assumed that it was the dust and gas was mixed. And they were coupled to so everything was moving. No one has considered this yet. If we can really decouple them in terms of evaporation, if we can, then I guess we can kind of see how long it takes to reduce the surface density at a given location to, let's say, half. But I think it's going to end up being pretty long. Anyway, yeah.
And also, so what's the reason for the gravitational radius moving in? Is it that the H2 region is hotter, or is it?
It's the flow, right? If you look at in their simulations, they have a. It's not just a flow going upwards like this, but they have a flow inside the gravitational radius that moves like this and then moves outside the gravitational radius.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Councillor Girl.